Welcome back to another episode of Titans of Now. Titans is a showcase of ServiceNow personalities that have punched above their weight and elevated the ServiceNow community. Titans of Now is brought to you by me, Robert the Duke Fedoric. If you want to see what I'm up to, check out my website, theduke.digital. Here you'll find all my CJ and the Duke episodes, links to my YouTube content, and my upcoming course, Hired, the Definitive Guide to Profiles That Win ServiceNow Jobs. Hey everyone, welcome back to another Titans of Now. So good to have you here. This episode's Titan has been a long-standing member of the ServiceNow community, a real OG, working both at Mothership and at ServiceNow Partners. She has been a legendary trainer, and those of us who have been in the ecosystem long enough may have actually had their admin course with her. She is a longtime ServiceNow architect and has been the backbone of one of the most legendary ServiceNow partners in existence. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Carlene Four Keeps Carter.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
It's my pleasure. Sorry I didn't have you sooner.
Well, I've been starting to get back into the community to spread my knowledge around and not just keep it to myself.
Isn't it crazy that you could take like a couple year hiatus of being involved in the community and then it's like most of the people haven't heard of you before?
Yes, exactly. This definitely exploded. I mean, it's still such a small ecosystem. Still, there are people jumping from customer to customer and partner to partner, but there are a considerable more amount of people here in the community and involved in ServiceNow today than there was when I first started.
That's really why we have Titans of ServiceNow too, is just there's so many people who, you know, essentially had the whole team up on their back running that touchdown. And I just want people to know like where it all came from, who were the people who made it go. And there's tens of thousands of us now, but time was there were dozens.
Yes, we could all fit around a conference room table.
That's
and,
right.
just help each other out.
That's right. I remember being at the wooden spaceship. And were you ever at the wooden spaceship?
I was. That is where the majority of my ServiceNow career was.
I just remember going there and the bottom floor was completely bare, except for a set of surfboards on one wall. And we were like, cool decoration. And they're like, what decoration?
It wasn't really a decoration.
No.
People would actually take those surfboards and go surfing during lunch or after work.
But there's this big empty space and they're like, this is where all the desks are going to go.
It did eventually get filled up with a large cube with desks in there, and several of the professional services people that were based in San Diego were all in that, all on conference calls, all at the same time. It was kind of like a bullpen, and we did our best. And then we ended up moving to the Carmel Mountain buildings, I think it was.
Okay, so I forgot to ask the question. So it's like we're talking about your start at ServiceNow. How did you start at ServiceNow?
I think if we really want to figure out how I started at ServiceNow, we have to go back a few years before that. I worked at a large desktop outsourcing company, and I started right out of high school on a service desk, and I was a CSAT data analyst. I actually don't even remember what the title was, but I basically called people back after they had an incident or a request completed, and I asked them how our technician did. So customer satisfaction surveys, as you can imagine, I didn't do that for very long because it was automated.
Yeah, I was going to say people did that. Well,
yes, it was a great foray into IT for somebody who, again, was literally out of high school. So after that was automated, I moved up to the actual service desk and I started taking emails that came into our group email box and I created tickets from those. And then that was automated.
Oh, the processing of tickets?
Yes. So like I literally took an email, copied and pasted it into a ticket, got the right category on it, routed it to the right place.
So you used to be an inbound action, huh?
I did. My claim to fame. I was an inbound action. Yes. So then after that was automated, I then started answering phones. And I think my favorite thing to do was set up an Outlook profile just the when it actually resolved the server name. I don't know why that was like golden for me. So, I mean, it was really all this real, real basic stuff that you learn at being on a, you know, a basic service desk.
Mm-hmm.
That was all of those positions were as a subcontractor to that company. And I eventually started looking for full-time employment. I still stayed with that company, but I ended up on the back end of the service desk as a workflow coordinator who took tickets that came from the service desk, made sure they were categorized correctly, and then assigned them to people. And I'm sure you can guess where this is going.
All I'm thinking is, like, automated. Are we going to have a category tree talk here? And I'm just going to go on a crazy rant.
They didn't actually need people to do that. That could be automated, right? So I'm racing against automation after automation. And it didn't bother me because nobody actually wants to do any of those things. We could do a lot more fun stuff. But anyway, so at that point, they offered me this new and exciting project that was supposed to be 30 days long. And they called it IT asset management. And that was never automated. Unfortunately, some of the things that I was doing was not automated, but it was not a 30-day project. If you are familiar at all with IT asset management, it's never done. There's no, hey, let's go do something for 30 days and then we're great again.
Yeah.
So I first did a lot of things where we had our desktop technicians capturing information and then sending it to me via fax. And then I would fax it over to an offshore team to actually put it in data entry. And that should have actually been automated, but it actually was faster for me to type that in rather than standing at a fax machine all day. Mm-hmm. I was really hungry to find something that wasn't like these administrative tasks.
Right.
So I started making myself more known in the desktop area. And 8 years and a college degree later, I did a lot of things with IT asset management, but I was looking for something else. And the only way to move up within that company was to move out of San Diego. So I started talking to some of my former colleagues and landed an interview with ServiceNow Professional Services. It was 2008, and I really thought that the position was like a business analyst because that's kind of what I had been looking for. I didn't have any JavaScript experience. I did have an HTML class from college, but I didn't really do much with that. So I was thrown right into the fire. I think on my third week, I was sent to Ohio and I had never seen snow. So there's a lot of firsts going on. Mm-hmm. Working with JavaScript and the Ohio State guys, they actually were afraid because the rental car company had given me a Mustang to drive in the snow.
Holy cow, for a second there, I thought you were calling ServiceNow snow, like you'd never seen
snow. No.
And I'm like, you're not one of those people, are you?
No, I had never seen snow falling, and this was the first time. I actually made the hotel receptionist come outside after work one day and take a picture of me making a snow angel.
Was the snow packy enough to do that?
It was, although I don't know that I would have known the difference. Mm. Anyway, so long story short, that was probably the shortest part of my overall career because I spent the next 3 years at ServiceNow, then was at a small boutique firm called Efficient Technology, and now I am at Acorio.
What did you do for that first little bit at ServiceNow?
I did a lot of different things. I was definitely technical on a lot of projects, but I also was thrown into teaching the basic sysadmin class. So as you mentioned during the intro, there, between 2009 and 2011, there was almost a 50-50 chance that I was your basic system admin trainer. If it was on the West Coast, it was probably me. If it was on the East Coast, it was probably Ian Bros.
He did my training.
Yeah, I actually just saw him at the last in-person knowledge, which seems like it was over a decade ago. And that had been the first time I had seen him in a long time. He's a great guy.
And what are you doing now?
So I just hit 7 years at Acorio, so over 12 years total on the platform. So I think the shorter answer probably would have been, what haven't I done? Mm-hmm. I served in just about every single role on project. I did actually do EM for a couple projects, but never again. Thank you to all the EMs out there. You are wonderful. I don't want to do your job.
Yeah, the good ones are miraculous, right?
Yes, exactly. Mostly I've been a technical architect. I also do a lot of work with our pre-sales and sales folks to help close deals and talk to them about how our delivery team is our experts in their areas and how we will not just do exactly what you tell us to do. We're going to question and make sure that what you're asking for is actually something that's going to live on and be scalable, you know, all the ables, scalable, maintainable, upgradable. All of those things.
All the ables is going to be the soundbite for this episode. Thank you for that. That is so, so good. So you've done a lot of things with ServiceNow, but what is the one thing that resonates the most with you? Like, for me, it's reporting and thinking about things in terms of outcomes. How about you?
So my favorite thing to do is take kind of a complex problem that somebody wasn't sure exactly how to solve and figure out how to solve it with as much out of the box as possible. And that sometimes just seems like, oh, Carlene, you just don't want to do any work. It's actually not the case. I want to make sure that I'm not building something that is going to break in, you know, a couple of releases or something like that. So let me give you an example. I was recently working with a customer who provides data center services, and they were implementing ITSM and CSM. And they were not using ServiceNow Discovery. They were using another tool to bring in all of their CMDB data. And they needed a way to automate the creation of install base items, which is part of the CSM suite. And I could have just gone and written really custom script include that, you know, just created the install base items that they had specifically mentioned. But what I decided to do instead was extend the data lookup tables and create rules. So we created install base items for all of the managed services, for all of their server monitoring, for all of their different things. And I set up condition filters and, you know, active flag, all of that stuff so that it, they could actually maintain it and not have to touch my code ever again, in theory.
It's what they call data-driven, so, right?
Exactly. Using data-driven and dynamic everywhere in the platform has been my mission.
We've just heard about one thing that you're super proud of, but could you tell us about, and this could overlap a bit, but could you tell us about a time where you didn't think you were going to make it? Like you just, it was just way too, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The place where your back's against the wall and it's only you, like nobody's going to get you out of it.
Absolutely. So there's been a lot of different things that anybody who's been on the platform for any length of time has run into one of these things before. There was the one time that I used 500% CPU on an instance with a global business rule, because at the time, this was early on, I did not know that you were supposed to wrap your global business rule in a function. I never did that again. Please do not shoot me. But I also was an administrator on High for a while, and I was trying to do some cleanup there. And some of the cleanup accidentally deleted the default view.
It's
not a good situation. And actually, one of your other Titans yelled at me a lot for doing it, although I did prove that it was not my update set that actually deleted it. Jared Latham was that Titan. And we're friends now. We became friends again. More recently, I accidentally turned on an email in a customer's dev instance and sent a bunch of comms to their external customers, which doesn't seem like a big deal, but it is actually a big deal. And
when it's external customers,
right? The more difficult part was to actually own up to actually doing it and then running a bunch of quick queries and scripts to figure out exactly who we sent emails to so that they could target their, we're doing a new ServiceNow deployment communication back to them. I think that there's been a lot of times where I was doing a re-implementation for a customer, and I was a technical architect, and we had planned everything down to the minute. And we had done as much like prepping with ServiceNow as we could. And at that time, we were supposed to cut over. Everything fell apart. None of the actions that we needed ServiceNow to actually do were occurring. And so we were all in a war room, and I was scrambling around to try to figure out how we would solve the problem, and came up with some interesting solutions to bridge the gap until we could get those ServiceNow pieces up and running. But if you're ever doing a re-implementation, make sure you involve ServiceNow early and often.
No kidding. So it was a re-architecture project?
And you know, for long-term customers, I don't like to think that there's any shame in doing a re-implementation. For long-term customers, more than half the stuff that's there today wasn't there. And so in order to do something, you had to build it. And sometimes after years and years and years of building it, the right answer is to just, okay, let's start fresh and be able to take advantage of all of the new functionality. There is the option of trying to go unravel yourself from all of the years of building, but usually the return on investment isn't there if you've been a long, 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 long-term customer.
Yeah, the whole like tech debt thing, right? And it's just...
Yeah.
You know, in some ways I understand you can't wait for ServiceNow all the time. Like the example I always bring up is ITBM with time card days. It's mm-hmm. it's in the system now, but for everybody who is doing monthly billing based off of time prior to that, like, what were they supposed to do? Not do that? So, yeah. Like, there's stuff you had to build. I'm still of the opinion that if you have good architecture and good principles and practices, that you can make that drag on for a very long time. Like, good architecture is good architecture, but
yes, yeah, absolutely. And there are things that were built in back in 2009 that are still running great today on different customers. I think that, like, IT asset management is another great example. I think they ServiceNow kind of avoided it for a long time. And then when was it? Jakarta? No, Jakarta was when SAM came out. It was one of the early Citi releases when they released the new asset management tables that are basically syncing with the CMDB. And then now, I mean, we're just now seeing light years of enhancements that are going into software asset management and hardware asset management. And a lot of the things that are out there, disposal processes, mm-hmm. Refresh processes, I could swear every single partner has built over and over again, at least one time. And there are some of those will probably live on for quite a while until it just really makes sense for those customers who have some of that functionality to switch on to something like Hardware Asset Management Pro.
People say asset management, and I liken that to saying construction. Like, mm-hmm. what are you talking about? There's like dozens of disciplines within this umbrella. You don't...
Umbrella is exactly the term that I use. And when I had my IT asset management workshop, that I used to have this giant rainbow umbrella and all of the things that asset management is underneath it. And, you know, I say asset management is never done, but asset management is also everybody's responsibility. It's your responsibility as an employee of a company who has given you equipment to be a good steward of that equipment, mm-hmm. not to throw it off into a pool or kick it down the road at an airport because you're angry or something like that. That's part of asset management, in addition to all the way up to getting to that utopia of total cost of ownership and understanding not just how much something costs when you first buy it, but how much it's going to cost you over the time that you have it from a maintenance perspective, all the software that goes on it, you know, all of the technicians that you're paying to support it if it doesn't work, or train people if they're not as tech savvy as they need to be. Mm-hmm. It's all of the money that goes into owning just a laptop is much more than the cost of it at the checkout counter.
Yeah. Can we just sit on asset management for a bit?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't asset management the single hottest thing in the ServiceNow community? And I say that because, like, I never came up in that asset management discipline. And I think, listen, if you take one thing away from this presentation, folks, go and sit with somebody in asset management, like not a ServiceNow expert in asset management, but like an asset manager who's probably going to be in your finance or accounting departments, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And just talk to them about the dollar signs involved in this.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why ServiceNow hit software asset management first, is because of the money that you could save, because people just buy and buy and buy and buy and buy licenses because they don't have an idea of how much that they have or ones that they could reclaim. People who may have moved departments and don't actually need Adobe, you know, most expensive anymore. All of those different things really add up to a lot of dollars. And I always like to recommend that customers start out with hardware asset management before trying to tackle software asset management. Because if you don't have an understanding of the hardware that's out in your environment, it doesn't matter how much reporting you're going to do on software. If you're missing a whole slew of servers or a whole slew of laptops, then your numbers are going to be off and your compliance is going to be off ultimately. But I don't know why. I think the idea that I mentioned earlier, that IT asset management is everybody's responsibility, a lot of folks are very resistant to that. So I also mentioned when I was an asset manager, I had our desktop technicians collecting asset management information for me. Every incident where they went out, they would write down the asset tag number, who it was assigned to, and the location. And if they were nice to me, they would write down any additional information I could validate. And then we would actually not just do the data entry that I mentioned, but we would actually validate that against our database. And if something was vastly off, we would then go investigate it. But there was this mind shift that all IT asset management stuff has to be done by the asset managers. which it's actually not true. I mean, there's procurement, there's the finance department, there's the actual asset managers who may set the policies and do some investigations, but we also have auto discovery, right? An auto discovery tool is doing asset management. If you haven't seen something on the network in whatever your threshold is, 30 days, 60, 90 days, if you have information from your ticketing system, from your auto discovery tool, that's going to help you try to find that asset. And actually, the sooner you look for it is the more chance you have to actually find it and not just classify it as missing at some point.
I think one thing a lot of people have trouble with in the asset management space, though, is this idea that if I've discovered it and if it's in the CMDB, then it is an asset.
No, not everything should be an asset. So that's also something that we talk about a lot in our asset management workshops. So there's software asset management, there's software assets, there's hardware assets, and then there's consumables. And each company kind of defines their different rules for consumables. I like to talk about them like keyboards, mice, monitors is one that can go either way, especially the really large ones or big ticket items. But things like hard drives discovered by ServiceNow Discovery, and tracking that beyond just discovering what's inside of the device is actually incredibly labor intensive, especially once it might be moved around. And what's the importance of that? There is some security importance around that. And after something comes out of the environment, you may be disposing of it. You might have that hard drive sit on in your depot or your stock room for a while as a quarantine, just in case, or legal hold. Mm-hmm. But there's plenty of things that are discovered by discovery or any auto discovery tool that don't have any sort of financial impact to the company.
You said, because my layman's dumb litmus test, right? I've always told people is it's an asset when finance tells you it's an asset.
Yeah. It has to have some sort of financial impact to the company. So like depreciation or licensing cost or, you know, maintenance cost or something like that. You might have contracts against an asset. A lot of those things, but a business service is not an asset. That's not necessarily, well, it is discoverable through service mapping more. But it's more of an intangible thing.
Right.
It is made up of a lot of assets.
That's right. Yeah. I think people need to realize that it isn't a financial term. It is not an IT term. People were saying assets and asset management like before we had typewriters.
Yeah. Another good example is virtual machines. So because virtual machines get discovered as computers, they will often just automatically create an asset.
Mm.
And you can actually avoid that by finding those virtual machine models and putting the asset tracking strategy to don't create assets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to help you get rid of a lot of assets that you can't find physically.
That could be a huge problem, wouldn't it? Because if you're logging them as assets and finance thinks they're assets, then they're putting a certain amount of depreciation, which could mean that they're fudging the numbers, if not by intent.
Yeah. Finance usually uses the numbers from the ERP rather than necessarily numbers from ServiceNow. But that's not to say that the details from ServiceNow never get back to finance, but it's more of finance typically will take their word as gold rather than something that you might have shown from ServiceNow. So as an asset manager, it's your job to help them understand that whatever you're showing to them might be true. But you don't actually need virtual machines, even if you have to count licenses, software licenses for those. You really only need them in the CMDB because software asset management uses the software installs table, and the install table is tied to CIs. It's not tied to assets.
Mm.
Okay. The licenses themselves have to be assets, but the virtual devices that the things are on do not have to be assets.
So, wow, that was a lot about ITAM, but is there any other parts of the platform that you really resonate with?
Yes, absolutely. I obviously have a background in ITAM, so I end up on those projects a lot, and I'm a great contributor to those projects, but I would love to actually be working more on the platform itself and in custom apps and other spaces like CSM. I also have service desk experience too, a lot of automation service desk experience, if you were paying attention at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. The thing you said at the beginning was all the ables. And, you know, it's clear that you have some flair for like just general architecture as well, which is a thing separate from the actual implementations that you can do. There is a discipline of those who just stand watch over it all and say, let's hold off that tech debt doomsday for as long as possible. So it seems like you have some flair for that as well.
I do, and I don't think that we have mentioned, I don't talk about it a whole lot, but I am one of the first certified master architects. So I was in the pilot cohort, which was in 2019. I think there's about 120-ish of them today in the world. So it's a privilege to be part of that group.
Okay. You must have some piece of advice for people just making their ServiceNow journey. What would you tell people to be mindful of, or any advice that you could give?
You can go wide, but there's no way that you will ever know anything. There's not one person on this planet that knows absolutely everything that's going on in ServiceNow at any one point in time. And so I think trying to find a place where you have experience or you have a particular affinity for it, even if you don't know it very well, you know, maybe portal or CSM or HR, do your research, try to specialize in that area. Don't forget the other areas of the platform, but having that specialization will help you understand how what's going on in the platform. I think if you're very, very first starting out, I want everybody to think very carefully about adding checkboxes to your tables. Think again, and then think like 73 more times. My hands are waving. I don't know if you can hear that. And then just don't do it. A checkbox type field only ever has two options. And I talked about scalability earlier. Checkboxes don't scale. Think about how you or your customer is going to be using this in the future and build for that. That's going to help you not have to do that re-implementation. And it's not just checkboxes, although I say checkboxes are the bane of my existence. But think about the long game. How is this going to be used? You don't have to try to boil the ocean, but don't code yourself into a corner by limiting your options. I think the other thing is add ATF, Automated Test Framework. Adding that as you develop and not trying to wait till the end to do it, because at that point, it's an insurmountable task and everything else will be more important than that. We actually implemented a policy internally that you can't push anything to production unless it has ATF. And if ATF doesn't apply, then we just do test steps. But it has to have some of those things in order to be pushed to production.
Amen. Amen. And not just ATF too, but like, I'm going to just jump on my documentation, just like grab the bat and beat that dead horse for a little bit, if you don't mind. Because a lot of people say, oh, it takes so much time, so it must not be valuable. Like, no, first of all, it is super valuable. It's super valuable. And the reason it takes too long is because you wait like a full week, weeks, months after the deployment to go back and try and remember what you did and why to document it. And if you'd have just been doing it while you're in the weeds, it would have been way easier.
Exactly. And I think the opposite is true. It takes so much time, so it's not valuable. It takes so much time. And it is one of the most valuable things, because if you spend the time to do it now, you will not have to spend the time to do repeated tests over and over and over and over again, which is not stuff that developers don't want to have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ATF's a monster, right? Like, it's, I don't know if it's just I haven't looked at it for long enough or I haven't got enough time in the seat, but it strikes me as it's onerous, right? It's not...
It is kind of tedious.
Yeah,
it is. But because you have to write out it's even more intensive than just writing out test steps, because you have to make sure that you're telling the system to do every little thing, and something that might be described as one line on a test script could actually be four or five actions in a test.
Well, actually, it's funny. I don't take sponsorships on Titans of Now, but somebody you mentioned earlier, Jared Latham, mm-hmm. has got a Titans episode, and I think everybody should go take a look at that one as well if you're interested in ATF and the difficulty to value proposition. There's some useful stuff in that episode.
I think the last thing that I would say to somebody starting out new is to be willing to be wrong. You're going to learn a heck of a lot more from being wrong than just being successful the first time, every time. Definitely celebrate your successes, but don't be afraid of being wrong. Don't be afraid of failing to do something, because you will learn from it.
Definitely. And a sage advice and a great final word. Carlene, we are at time. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. We will talk to you later.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
Bye.
Do you want your message in front of the best ServiceNow admins, developers, architects, and product owners in the business?
Want a conversation about your ServiceNow strategy and architecture? You can reach me via my website at www.theduke.digital. If you want to contribute to high-frequency, high-quality ServiceNow content, all you need to do is
feed the algorithm
with likes, shares, and comments. Thanks for watching.